My name is Paul Price, and I'm honored to chat with Mr. Richard Masser for the Actors Fund on Wednesday, November 2nd, 2016, at the Actors Fund in New York City, New York. Oral History 2 of 3. Good afternoon, sir.
Afternoon.
Yeah, good to sit with you again. So, I wanted to pick up this this interview talking a little bit about your thoughts on conservatory training and graduate programs preparing young actors for the profession, and your thoughts on that.
Well, this will be fairly quick. As you probably know, I attended the Yale School of Drama, but I was I don't know that I was the worst student ever at Yale. I was certainly the most unorthodox student among many unorthodox students. What happened was I got there because I was working at the Williamstown Theater Festival, and well, it was only the Williamstown Theater then, in 1969, and it was run by Nico Sakharopoulos, who taught directing at the drama school. Consequently, there were a lot of drama school people up at Williamstown, and one of them was the head of the apprentice program, who was a woman named Lynn Meadow, who then went on to become the artistic director of the Manhattan Theater Club, which she's been for 40 years, I think, and or pretty close. So, weirdly, Lynn had gone to school with my sister, went to university with my sister at Bryn Mawr College, and I had actually met her a couple of times when my sister was there. So when I first saw her, she looked familiar to me, but also I looked familiar to her, and as she came over, she said hello, I said hello, anyway, I was up at Williamstown as an assistant tech director. I wasn't in the apprentice program, but every season, at the beginning of the season, they would audition any of the apprentices who wanted to audition for consideration possibly to be used in the company. So I went to Lynn and I said, I know I'm not really in the apprentice program, but I want to act, so would you mind? And she said, no, go ahead. So I auditioned. I did a couple of things, and afterwards she said, you're very good. What are you doing when you leave here? I said, I don't know. This was the beginning of the summer. I said, I had no clue. She said, well, if you have nothing else going on, you should get yourself to New Haven, because if you're there and you're around the drama school, they will cast you in drama school productions, because there's no one like you at Yale. No one even vaguely like you. I said, okay, that's interesting. So it gave me a little direction, figuratively and literally. And while I was working at Williamstown, I built a set that was designed by a man named Santo Acquasto, who's quite a famous set and costume designer and art production designer for film now. And this was directed by a man named Arvin Bran, who at the time ran a theater in New Haven called the Long Wharf. Now, the other assistant technical director that year was a guy named Joe Galinsky, who was from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And Joe had kind of wangled himself a job at the Long Wharf for the coming season as an assistant tech director. So after I built, I was in charge of this particular set. Joe wasn't involved. So after I built the set for Arvin, while we were doing tech rehearsals, I said, is there any chance you guys might have any jobs open? And he told me to call the guy who ran, Edgar, who ran his the kind of business end of the theater, the production end. And I did, and he said, well, our prop mistress isn't coming back, so that's open. Would you be interested in doing props? And I said, I'd love to. He said, okay, good. So when are you coming to New Haven? I said, well, I'll come as soon as the season's over. And Joe had already gotten himself an apartment in New Haven, which he was looking for a roommate for, so we roomed together. And I moved to New Haven, and I called up Edgar, and I said, when shall I start? And he said, oh, no, the problem has just changed your mind. She's coming back. I don't have anything for you. I said, I just moved to New Haven. What do you mean you don't have anything? He said, no, I'm sorry. It's just, yeah. So I was kind of like, oh, what am I going to do? And I ran around New Haven and picked up a job hustling beer and burgers at a place called Hungry Charlie's. And I was not a good fit with New Haven in 1969 because I had kind of long hair and a beard, and I wore, you know, like, I was very hippie looking, and Yale was totally not that in 1969. It was still very, you know, wheat jeans and Izod shirts and button down, you know, light blue shirts and Oxford shirts. So, and most of the customers were guys, and they weren't tipping me, you know, and I wasn't all that polite to them, I guess, either. So I was making almost no money. And one day this woman named Carol Wasser walked in, and Carol had been the assistant stage manager at Williamstown that summer. And so we knew each other from there, and she saw me there. She said, what are you doing here? And I told her the sad story. She said, well, you're a great technician. You shouldn't be working here. So she went to the head of the technical department at the drama school and the Yale rep, and she talked to him. He brought me in, interviewed me, and he had a kind of a half position available, which he didn't have enough money for, but it was way more than I was making at Hungry Charlie's. And so I took it, and I was doing some lighting, a little bit of lighting design, a little bit of lighting technician work, and some light carpentry, and then generally filling in when necessary. But mostly I worked in the in these two little theaters, the studio and the cabaret theater. Anyway, that's how I got to Yale. And one day, because the cabaret theater was in what was during the day the snack bar, so everyone in the drama school would be in there every day. And I was hanging around there, putzing around with lights or whatever. And one day a guy came over to me and he said, hey, listen, they're auditioning for this thing, for this third year directing project, and you should go over and audition because he has no idea what he wants for this one role. So I did. I went over, I met with the guy, you know, we talked. He cast me in this thing. So it was a four-hander. There were four people in it. One of whom was a guy named James Naughton, who went on to do a lot of things in the theater and movies and television. And me and two women. I'm so embarrassed. I can't remember one of their names, the younger woman's name, but the other was a woman named Barbara Damashek. And it was this surrealistic French play by a man named Boris Vian, and it was called The Empire Builders. And we did this piece, and I played a character called the Schmerz, which in German means pain. And my character was completely sort of fantastical. I was this presence. Whenever they would come into a new space, I would already be there. And I was swathed in bandages and had blood dripping off me. And whenever they were angry or scared or frustrated, they would come over and they would hit me. And that was basically, that was my role, was I got the crap kicked out of me by these three people. Now, we rehearsed this stuff very carefully. And you know, there was very little danger. And I was padded up and everything. But opening night, Jimmy comes through the door in the first scene, slips, falls right on his butt, and he's carrying a toolbox, which he jammed his finger when he hit the ground and kind of dislocated his finger. And he was supposed to come over to me like a few moments later and throw a punch at me, and his hand is in screaming pain. I don't know any of this. I saw him fall, but I didn't realize he'd done this to his hand. So he comes over to me, and instead of punching me, which we had rehearsed many times, he throws an elbow at me, and as he threw the elbow, I was doubling over to take the punch, you know, I was reacting as if he were about to punching me. And I popped my head down, and he clipped me with his shoulder, just caught my chin, and I went out like a light. I've always had a glass jaw. And I was totally out, and he's pounding away at me, and he's holding me up with his other hand. And he's going, "Dick, Dick, hey, Dick." And I, you know, I finally go, what? He says, "You're up?" I said, okay. And then he let go of me, and I went stumbling off, and we went on with the play. And, you know, we finished the opening night performance. Jimmy got his hand splinted up. He played the rest with it. And we routined some new stuff, so I wasn't getting knocked out all the time. Anyway, Robert Brustein, who was the head of the drama school, saw that piece, and he came back to congratulate everybody. And they were all third-year acting students except me, and I was this mystery man he'd never seen before. So he came over, he introduced himself, and he said, "Boy, you were really good." I said, "Oh, thank you." It was a great acting exercise because I had to stay present and alive the entire time. And the third act of the play, it's only me and Jimmy, and it's basically a dialogue, even though he has all the words. But he's reacting to me, who is sort of mutely with my eyes and my body, which is all twisted up, kind of trying to respond to him. And it was a tremendous exercise. So Brustein said, "Who are you?" And I said, "My name is Richard Masser. I'm a technician. I work at the cabaret and the studio theater." He said, "Really? Well, boy, have you ever thought about acting? Because you're very good." And I said, "Well, that's what I'd like to do, but, you know, this is what I can do right now, so I'm doing it." He said, "Well, keep it up." A few months later, I get cast in another third-year directing project, which is pissing off some of the third-year acting students. I want to underscore that. I had a little bit of trouble with a few of them. And in this one, it was a Sam Shepard play called La Turista, and I played two roles in it. And one was this kind of weird witch doctor, this is sort of Mexican, it's called Witch Doctor in the piece, but it's actually a shaman. And in the other part, I play this kind of gun-toting, you know, Doc Holliday kind of doctor. So I'm a doctor in both pieces, but it's incredibly insane, makes no sense at all. But it was a lot of fun to do. So after that one, Bob Brustein came back and he said, "Okay, look, this is enough already. Do you want to come to school here as an actor?" And I said, "Boy, I don't have any money. You know, this costs a lot. I can't." He said, "Well, let's see if we can work that out. If we can work that out, do you want to come to school here?" And I said, "Well, the other thing is you don't let your first-year students act in productions. You know, they're only allowed to go to class." And I just did two third-year projects, so I'd feel weird if I wasn't able. He said, "We'll figure that out, too." And I said, "Well, if you're going to figure everything out, okay, great." So I went there for a year, which was kind of nuts in that I really didn't have enough money with everything. They gave me a tuition scholarship and also some work study and some little stipend, but it just didn't add up to enough. So I went through every dollar I had in savings during the course of that year, and mostly what I had time to do, because Brustein cast me in two of the rep company shows, which only third-year students were allowed to do. So the schedule at the school was designed so that the third-year students would be free in the afternoons for rehearsal. So I couldn't be in a bunch of the second-year courses, which they had originally assigned me to, so they moved me into all the third-year courses. So essentially, I took the third-year courses, and that year I was there, and only got to do one small thing at the drama school, which was also frustrating, because I'm carrying people's coats on the main stage at the rep company. I played the third murderer in the Scottish play and stuff like that, but in the school stuff, I played real roles. And anyway, at the end of the year, I went to him and I said, I don't know what to do about next year. And he said, "Well, you come back." I said, "As a student?" He said, yeah. I said, I can't afford it, Bob. You've been very generous, but I just can't. And at that point, I'd already had an offer to go to the Hartford Stage Company to be their tech director, which was going to pay me a real solid salary, like more than I'd ever made in my life. So I walked away. But and it's interesting. For many years, I thought that Brustein thought me an ingrate because I had left. And I saw him many years later at an event. It was a reading of a play he had written, actually, here in New York. And he just threw his arms around me and told me how proud he was of me. And I said, look, I've owed you an apology for years. He said, for what? And I said, because I came in and I said this to you. Because when he said, what do you want to do? When I said I couldn't be a student anymore, I said, well, hire me for the rep company. He said, oh, no, you're not ready. But, you know, a couple of years later, I was on Broadway. So maybe I was. I don't know. But I understand why he felt that way. So this is a very long answer to stuff about conservatories. Given that experience, my experience of that, of Yale and other sort of schools I've been involved with as a teacher as well as a student, is the best thing I can say is this, or maybe it's not the best, but the most accurate thing. I was in a class taught by a wonderful man named Lee Richardson, who was an actor in residence in the company and also taught this workshop, this third year workshop. And one day I do some scene, I forget what it was, and Lee is talking to me in what feels to me like this very absolutist way, which is the way you must approach this is blah, 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 blah. And I said, you know what I don't understand? I have a few different teachers and everybody tells me this one way I should be doing it. And they're mostly all in conflict with each other. And what I don't understand is I didn't ask to come here. I was asked to come here. So I must have been doing something right. And I was asked to come here because the guys saw me act. So instead of trying to tell me how I don't know anything and I'm doing it all wrong, why don't you try and figure out what I'm doing right and help me to do it more often? Help me to become more solid in where my natural, and then help me to stretch from there. And Lee said, that's a really good idea. You know, he didn't get angry at me, which he certainly could have. And we worked together years later and talked about that moment where I kind of said this in front of everybody. But it's kind of my feeling, and not all that many years, actually. A few years later, I was out in California, and I directed a production of a play that had some people in it who had just taken a six-week intensive course with John Strasberg, Lee Strasberg's son, who had come out to teach this course. And it was a scene study course. And they asked me after we finished, you know, after the play was up and running, they said, listen, the two of them had done this, and they said, we just did this course, and it was really, really great, but we think you would be able to do that even better. Would you consider doing a class? I said, I don't have anything to teach anybody. I don't know anything about acting class or anything. So finally I said, okay, as long as you don't care that there's not going to be any structure and I don't have any theories, fine, I'll do it, you know. And so we set it up. It was at the Zephyr Theater in Hollywood. It cost us $75 to rent. So they said, what do you want us to pay you? And I said, however many people are there, you guys will split the rent and we'll call it even. You know, I don't care. I don't feel like I'm bringing that much to the party. So for several months, I taught this class. It was great. It was very good for me and it was great for them. And I kept saying, I don't have any rules. I don't know anything is true. And then this amazing thing kind of happened along the way where I came up with two rules. And they're the only two rules I believe there are in this, in terms of this work. I also, by the way, just parenthetically, I had People could come in with scenes that they had worked on, scenes they were reading cold, auditions they were going up for if they wanted to work on those, or anything else they felt like doing. And whatever it was, we'd all watch, and then nobody participated but me. I would just say, okay, well, let's go back. Let's talk about it. What are you going after here? And what's, and you know, why are you limping? And the guy, you know, the guy would say, I don't know. I just thought it would be interesting. And this was rule number one. If something is well written, if it's not in the text, it's not on the page, it probably doesn't belong in your performance. Don't stick stuff on top of the character that isn't called for if it's well written. Now, if you're going to do an episode of, you know, Starsky and Hutch, bring whatever toys you want and try and be as weird and wild and wonderful as you can be based on, you know, what they'll let you do. But if it's a good piece and it's well written, give some credit to the fact that they know who the guy is. And then you have to discover your version of that guy, not create a new guy who limps and drools and, you know, has his finger in his ear all the time. That doesn't make sense. So that was one rule. And the other rule that I came up with, which I was particularly excited about, was the thing that makes you most uncomfortable that you want to gloss over or change, you know, where you just don't want to say the line or it just makes you, that may be the key to the character. And if it's well written, again, if it's well written, and here's what I mean. If you take a connect the dots thing, so you have all these dots and they're numbered and you're supposed to connect them in a certain order. And then there are a couple of dots that are up here and they don't make sense with the picture that you've decided this is turning into. And you just go, no, I'm going to ignore this. You may not realize that the guy has horns or pointy ears or antlers or whatever. You know, there may be, or a beard. You may be cutting out, obviously this is all metaphorical, but you may be cutting out an essential element of who the character is because you decide, oh, this doesn't fit with my picture. Adjust your picture to what's actually there. Again, if it's well written. If it's not well written, you know, fuck it. Do what you want to do. But if it's, I've been really careful so far. That was my first slip. Apologies to anyone listening. But if it's, but so those are the only two rules I came up with. And I realized that I have violated those rules myself, certainly. I mean, one of the first things I do, especially as a director, when I'm working on new material and I have access to the playwright, is I start saying, what does this mean? Why is this here? Is that right? Is that real? What about this? This feels much more authentic to where you're going. And every playwright I've worked with so far has thanked me because the pieces have improved. However, every once in a while I catch myself doing it and I go, no, wait, this deserves, or the playwright will say, let's just change that. And I go, no, wait, let's protect that. Let's see, maybe I'm wrong, maybe he's wrong, or maybe she's wrong. Let's just wait a minute, and let's give it a couple of three more days and see what we find. So, but basically, those are the two rules I came up with. And my overall feeling about the Academy, as it were, is, and this is, you know, a lot of people won't like this, I'm sure, is that I know many people who've gone to the best drama schools here and in England and in Australia, and many people who have benefited greatly from them. So I will never say they're not great and they don't have tremendous benefit, including people I know who I was at Yale with and who went to Yale before or after I did. So all of these schools, I think. But to a large extent, and I think this has changed now, to a large extent, what drove me nuts was when I was there, I felt like what Yale was set up to do was to create actors who were basically utility players who could do regional theater and exist and try and make a life in the theater in a world which had nothing to do with that. I'm not saying that that wasn't a possibility that some people actually went and did. But the vast majority of the people in this country, even back in 69, 70, 71, the vast majority of the people in this country, in England, maybe a little later, in Australia, maybe a little later, were going to be making their living across a broad range of media. And we were not trained, nobody was even interested in training us to do that. So every single person I know who came out of drama school around the time I did anyway, came out with no tools whatsoever to go into the film or television industry. Now, if you're like me, or somebody like, say, Henry Winkler, who was I was at drama school with, the first thing you're doing is you're asking everybody why they're doing what they're doing, and you're trying to learn the technical end of it to some extent. I mean, I don't know that Henry did this to the extent that I did, but this all I did initially was run around and ask everybody on the crew what they were doing and why that piece of equipment. Now, I had a technical background, but more importantly, in order to get comfortable, I would communicate directly with a guy who had his eye to the eyepiece on every I still do on every shoot I'm ever on. I'd say, is there anything I can do to help you? Is it better here or here? Are you here? Are you here? And I'd measure out, you know, what we call a close up or two T's, waist shot, cowboy, those are all sizes that come out of the movie business. Cowboy being the one where you can see the guns. So down to the middle of your thigh. So anyway, and hitting marks. Nobody tells you about marks. Nobody tells you how to hit marks. Nobody tells you how to hit marks without looking for them and embarrassing yourself at least a few times. Nobody tells you when you're in a close-up or in an over-the-shoulder and you're playing to somebody off camera, that if the camera is over the guy's right shoulder, you look at the right eye, not at the left eye. You never look at the left eye, because if you look at both, then your eyes go flopping back and forth. And if the camera's over the other shoulder, you look at the left eye. Nobody tells you that unless you ask the cameraman, the guy with his said not, well, we don't call it cameraman, that's the operator. And you say, is my look okay? And one guy fairly early on said to me, just stay with the eye closest to the camera. Don't look back and forth. Now, it's unnatural. It's not what we do with people. We look at their mouths. We look at their noses. We look at their foreheads. We look at their ears. We look all over the place. But when you do that on camera, your eyes seem to be wandering around, or the person seems to be moving, especially if you're in a tight shot. And you don't want that. So if you just focus in on... I've told this to so many actors that I've worked with who didn't know anything about that. Another great thing, I was working on a production of on the show called MASH, which was a television show from the movie, and Harry Morgan was on the show, and Harry Morgan was a hero of mine. He was one of the great character actors of his era, and real great supporting actor. He played a wide range of roles. He played Sergeant Friday. He played, on Dragnet, but he also played the judge in Inherit the Wind, and he was just astonishing in that. Anyway, we were talking one day about this, that, and the other thing, and this was like the fourth or fifth thing I'd done on film at that point. We were having a really nice chat, and I mentioned to him that Spencer Tracy was my idol, and he said, well, of course, he's all of our idols. I said, is it true, I read once that Tracy had this habit of sort of walking along and looking down and then suddenly looking up and talking to people. And the rumor was that Tracy was always looking for his mark, is why he did that. And Harry looks me right in the eye. He says, if you hear nothing else from me, remember this. Spencer Tracy never did that. He was the most camera savvy, professional person on a set I've ever met. And he said, and he was so camera savvy that he would say, like in a scene, if he was in a wide shot and a master, he would go, now wait a minute. And in a close up, he would go, now wait a minute. And his gesture would be adjusted to the size of the shot so that, because it's going to be a choice, you're going to use one or the other. And if they're back there, you need that presence. But if it's in close and you do it with that intensity, you look like a madman. It's unusable. This was like the fourth thing I did, and it clicked in my head. none of that stuff was getting taught in the academies. Now I understand Yale teaches some of that. I think yeah, a little bit. But still not enough, I think, because we're not doing it. Look, it's great to have an academic grounding, and I don't have as good an academic grounding as many of my peers do, who went through the full conservatory experience or graduate school experience. But I haven't needed it, you know, and I'm one of the few people that I came up with who has never had it to do something else for a living, who has consistently worked over now, I'm in my fifth decade, halfway through my fifth decade of working consistently, and who has a certain, if not good reputation, at least not negative reputation in the business in terms of my work and stuff. So, you know, for all those reasons, I think the main thing about the academy, the main thing about conservatories is get what you can from them, absolutely. If you can't, don't feel bad about it, don't feel less than. The other thing I will say, which I've seen a lot of, is the networking that comes from doing that can last a lifetime and a career. And I have tapped into very little of that, even though, I mean, I was at Yale with Henry, with James Naughton, with Jill Eikenberry, with Henry Winkler. Those are probably the best known people I was there with. I was around Yale, though, working at the Long Wharf when Meryl Streep started, when Joe Grafazzi started. Now, Joe and Meryl became fast friends, and Joe's worked on several things with Meryl. A guy named John Rothman and Meryl became best friends. And John's been in virtually every movie Meryl's ever made. And it's not out of pity. The guy's a really good actor. But the fact of the matter is, these things happen sometimes. So there are lots of good reasons to do it. I don't know. The way that some people think of, I mean, a degree doesn't do anything for you except one thing, and I'll just say that. I have been very frustrated throughout my, the last 20 years, knowing that I'm good in terms of how I talk to people as a director, in terms of how I interact with them as a teacher. I'm very good at that, and because I don't have a degree, it's hopeless. I mean, I just, many places I can't teach even if they were interested, and other places, because of what I've done, which is I was in California for a really long time. I wasn't part of the whole swim here in New York for a long time. Even though I have friends like Austin Pendleton and Mark Blum and other people who have been at HP for a long time, I've never been able to find my way into that. And it's something, if I have any regret about all my time working, it's that I haven't been able to figure out a good method of passing this on. Because I think that's part of our responsibility. I had a lot of gifts given to me along the way, and I've returned the favor in other ways. You know, my union work and stuff on, you know, as I was describing, helping people to understand how to make things easier for everybody, including themselves. But, you know, this is one element which I've been frustrated by, and it's my own fault. I don't have any degrees, so I don't have any degrees.
So just coming off of that a little bit.
That was very long.
No, that was great. It was excellent. Coming off of that, let's talk a little bit about the various hats that you wear as a director, you mentioned, as an educator, mm-hmm. As an activist mm-hmm. in the theater and in the business. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about that and where do you see yourself going wearing those different hats as a director, a technician, activist?
Well, everything that I've... Well, that's a very big question. Let me try and grab a little piece of it. First of all, when I started becoming somewhat recognizable on television, it coincided with some stuff that I did that I got involved with in terms of public policy stuff. And I was invited to be part of some things because I had some visibility that I was very happy and pleased to be part of, you know, having to do with issue-based politics, the women's equality movement in this country, the fight for the Equal Rights Amendment, protection of women's right to choose. You know, it's always very, especially in the women's rights area, it's always very important to have some men involved who don't, you know, who arguably don't have a dog in the hunt, but feel it's important on a human level, not on a gender-based level. So I got to do that, and that involved me with other issues, you know, political issues. And along the way, you know, like everybody knows this on some level, but you don't really know it until you experience it, is, you know, we all kind of live low to the ground. You know, if you picture us, like we're all in a trench, like a World War I trench, and the people who stick their heads up above the trench are going to get shot at. The people who are keeping their heads down are not. So the people who stand up, I mean, Hillary Clinton is a great example. Donald Trump is another example in another way. You have to be prepared to get fired at in ways that are really uncomfortable and potentially dangerous. And you don't always think about that before you decide to stick your head up over the edge of the trench. But I got that experience pretty quickly doing some things having to do with issue politics and then later electoral politics. And then I got a phone call from a guy I knew actually from my first summer at Williamstown, a man named Charles Siebert, who I hadn't talked to in forever. And he said he was asked to call me because there was an election coming up in the Screen Actors Guild, and they were trying to get some of the guys who hadn't worked in a long time out of there and get more working actors involved. And I'd been a member at this point for, you know, I don't know, 12, 13, 14 years. And he said, would you consider that? And I said, well, you know, I've been a member for a while and I've never even been in the building. I walked a couple of picket lines back in 1980, but this was 1989. I said, sure, I guess it's my turn to give something back. And he was flabbergasted. He was unbelievably surprised, because I know I've made these phone calls to other people in the years since, and mostly it's, I can't get involved in stuff like that, or it's, you know, the response is, well, maybe in a couple of years when this changes or that changes. So, or they're really angry about something, and yes, I will get involved because I hate the way this happens and that happens. I am one of the few people I've ever met who basically came in to do service at the Screen Actors Guild because somebody asked me and I said yes. And it was that simple. Mostly it comes from, most of the people who run are people who are angry about something, and it creates very, very conflict-oriented politics sometimes within the union. So I ran, and when I got elected, I was, because concurrently with that, I had been doing a lot of work, and I was really quite visible. So I was one of the more visible people on the union board at that moment in time. And a couple of years later, the man who was the third vice president, we had many vice presidents, but he was the third out of 13. He called me up prior to the next election, and he said, where I was, I didn't have to run, but he had to. And he said, listen, somebody else took a petition out to run against me, and I'm afraid he's going to get the nomination. Would you consider running for my seat? I said, no, that's your seat. I don't want to take that. Yeah, but this guy's running to try and knock me off. Now, the guy who was running happens to have been involved with the group that recruited me in the first place. So I said, well, I think that's bullshit. So yes, I'll happily do that. So I put in a petition. The minute my petition went in, the other guy pulled his petition because he just wanted that guy out. It was just petty nonsense. I ran. I was the third vice president. And then 2 years later, Barry Gordon, who had been the president the whole time, the first vice president was a man named Joe Ruskin. And Barry and I sat down together and I said, look, Barry, here's the thing. You've decided you're running again. I support you. Fine. I think I should run for the first and Joe should run for the third because Joe is kind of a lightning rod. I have less of that going on, number one. Number two, if you decide you're going off someplace to do something else, which he'd been making noises like he was going to run for bigger political office, I said, I think I'm better positioned to do this than you. Not that I want to be the president, but... And we talked about it, and he said he really wanted Joe to be the guy because I was working so much, Joe had more time. Joe was a wonderful, very, very versatile character actor. He'd worked for many years doing great stuff, and he was a great union guy, but a lot of people didn't like him. He was very acerbic. Anyway, we ran. He barely got elected. Come up on the next election, and Barry says he's going to run again. And I said, Barry, no, you can't do this. And he said, yes. And we had the same conversation. No, I'm lying about this. I'm lying about this. Now, this was that second year that this took place. And what happened was Joe lost. I apologize. Joe lost. And it was very, very disturbing. And then I said, okay, Barry, but if Joe loses, you cannot leave until your term is up. You can't let this other person become the president. That's exactly what happened. He left with about 8 months left to go. And this woman, Sumi Haru, who was the first Asian American to ever be the president of any labor union, so that was great. But she, in my opinion, was not the right person to be there. But the other thing that when Barry was talking about leaving, he called us both together and we had dinner together and he said, so I'm going to run for office. And I said, okay, here's the thing. If you do it this way, if you resign right after the board meeting, not before the board meeting, you resign right after the board meeting, Sumi will become the interim. We won't have to have any kind of a fight about it. If you resign before the board meeting, I will run against Sumi and I will defeat her. And Sumi, I will do it this way under one circumstance. You guarantee me you're not going to run in 2 years. I mean, at the end of the term. She did. We all did. She did it. She didn't run again. She ran for the first vice presidency again and won, much to my chagrin. But anyway, that's how I got in there, and that's how I became president. It was not anything I wanted to do, but I spent 10 years doing that and then becoming president. I lost an election, went away for a few years, and then came back because I saw a chance to merge the unions, which is something I dearly wanted to do, to merge Screen Actors Guild and Actors, the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists. Now, you asked a question about wearing hats. It's not the only thing about wearing that hat, taking on this position or any kind of union service, in my opinion, is that you cannot ever do anything while you're sitting in that position that somehow implies that the union is doing something which the union board and the membership have not agreed to do. So one of my predecessors, Ed Asner, who was a very good friend of mine for a long time, and we were very politically aligned, when he became the president of the Screen Actors Guild, it just happened to have happened at the exact moment that all this stuff was going on about the war in Nicaragua, the Contra War, this revolution in El Salvador, and Ronald Reagan was the president, and there was a lot of I was completely opposed to Reagan's policies, as was Ed. And there was a group called Medical Aid for El Salvador, that Ed had been very supportive of, and then he was elected to the presidency of the union. And he was asked to hand a check for $25,000 for money that had been raised for medical aid for El Salvador to the representative. Now, it was well known that medical aid for El Salvador was very closely allied with the political wing of the revolutionaries in El Salvador. And so Ed agreed to do this. It was a big press op. It was on, he did it on the steps of the U.S. Capitol. And it was like within a few weeks of his having been elected Screen Actors Guild president. So all of the press was SAG president Ed Asner gives check to medical aid for El Salvador. And this union, the Screen Actors Guild, is the most diverse organization on the planet. And I'll explain why. We have members who are 2 weeks old. We have members who are well into their 90s. We have people who have been on welfare for years and will probably die on welfare, and other people who make as much money as virtually anyone can imagine. We have people who are extremely left-wing, people who are extremely right-wing, everything in between. We have every ethnic group. We have every religious minority is represented. Everything you can imagine, it's all in the Screen Actors Guild. So when you're making a decision for how to speak on behalf of the union or present yourself on behalf of the union, you have to be very, in my opinion, very sensitive to the broad, varied thing you're sitting on top of. It's not unlike the United States of America, in my opinion. And what you can do is you can act solely in the interests of your constituents, whoever you consider them to be, working actors or, you know, principals, as opposed to, oh, that's the other thing we have. Principal performers, singers, dancers, stunt performers. We have background performers. We have, you know, again, huge spectrum of interests, some of which are conflicting at times. You have to be able to act in the best interests of the greatest number of people most of the time, or explain why you can't. Ed was uninterested in any of that. He felt he had the absolute right under the First Amendment to do whatever he wanted to do, and he did. But he didn't have the right to drag Screen Actors Guild down that road, and he created a lot of turmoil, which Chuck Heston was the other side of, and between the two of them, they ramped this up into this terrible, terrible scene. And we've had other bad scenes since then, and we will again in the future, I'm sure, that because it's such a visible entity, especially since the SAG Awards, which I was involved in helping to start. Barry was the first president for the first show, but I was there for the next four. And you know, it was a, and it did exactly what we hoped it would do, was it put a labor union on television. And we never, ever didn't present ourselves as a labor union. And the people who would get up, I mean, Tom Hanks, bless his pea-picking heart, what Tom Hanks stood up at the, when he won the award for Forrest Gump, he stood up, he got up, went up to the microphone, he said, you know, when you start out when you're a young actor, yeah, and you hope one day that you're going to be a real actor, and when you decide and you think the time has come, then you go out, and he reaches into his pocket, he takes out a SAG card, he says, and you get one of these, and that's what makes you a real actor. Well, it was just like the place went crazy. This was the first award show. Tom topped it off. From then on, we did a How I Got My SAG Card thing as part of all the openings, because Tom invented this idea. The fact is, he couldn't find his SAG card. It was an old one. It was like 2 years out of date, but nobody noticed. And I was the one who got to thank him for that, because Barry finished up, and then I took over, and that's how Tom and I really started to know each other. But anyway, it's this work is, and all you can do is do the best you can to prove them wrong by being who you are, which is an honorable person who's trying to do the right thing, which is what I've gone on to try and do. And there are people who you've got the right people who are well-known in the business to walk through here. Say, what do you think of Richard Master? They go, oh, my God, what a lying son of a bitch that guy is. You know, and then there are other people who say, if we only had him back, he was the best president the union ever had. What are you going to do? You know, so, but you have to, you know, and the thing that chaps me, I adjusted that, it's not the expression, but the thing that chaps me is a lot of, I also believe that everybody who's in the public eye by virtue of the fact that they're an actor or a performer or a singer or a musician, a dancer, anyone who achieves some kind of fame through performance is not immediately excluded from having a brain and an opinion about world affairs. So just because, you know, I hate it when somebody says, well, the actor, you know, Sean Penn or the actor, some of us go to tremendous lengths to inform ourselves, to educate ourselves, to, there was a time when I knew more about single-payer national health care any member of Congress than anybody in the government did. And this was during the time that Hillary Clinton was in 1993 when they were working on the health plan. And I was involved in that from as the chair of our legislative committee in the union. And I was in Washington all the time talking to people, lobbying on this. And I'd get into rooms with people who were perceived to be as experts, and they'd start talking about why what I was talking about was a problem. I would go, no, that's incorrect. Would you like me to send you the material? And this happened all the time, and it happens a lot with a lot of people like me. And any slob who makes a lot of money, witness this election, can get up and say any idiotic thing in the world, and they have some kind of gravity because they run a business. Well, screw that. Many of us who are in this business are as smart, as well-educated, as thoughtful as any of those people, and we're constantly, constantly berated for expressing our opinions publicly. This goes for sports people. I mean, it's right across the board. Now, if you can't listen to somebody and decide whether or not they seem to know what they're talking about, that's on you. That's not on them. They have every right to express themselves. But whenever you do, they're going to shoot at you. If you just stand there and, you know, when you can put a ball through a hoop like nobody's business and you don't ask people to think about anything else, no problem. That's not a bad thing. I don't mean to in any way imply that it's a bad thing. But if you're just going to do that, people aren't going to shoot at you. But on the other hand, the minute you stand up and you take a position, you know, like some of the stuff that's going on now about Black Lives Matter and all of that, then people start digging at you and attacking you when they should be saying, thank goodness these people are involved in their community. Thank goodness these people are standing up for what they believe in. I supported Chuck Heston 100%. For his position on the National Rifle Association, although I completely revile and hate what he had to say about it, but I supported his right to say it, as I think he supported mine. I don't know. He never had to stand up and say that, but I said that in public. I said that in print when people would go, how can you interact with this man? I would go, because he's standing up, he's putting himself on the line for something he believes in. And if more of us did this, this would be a better place. We would have honest debate, we would have open debate, we wouldn't be going around behind other people's backs. Anyway, enough out of
that. Yeah, great. Thank you, okay. Richard.
Yeah.